Chapter 4. If you have walked into a museum recently, whether you did so to attend an art exhibition or to escape from the police, you may have noticed a type of painting known as a triptych. A triptych has three panels, with something different painted on each of the panels. For instance, my friend Professor Reed made a triptych for me, and he painted fire on one panel, a typewriter on another, and the face of a beautiful, intelligent woman on the third. The triptych is entitled, What Happened to Beatrice, and I cannot look upon it without weeping. I am a writer, and not a painter, but if I were to try and paint a triptych entitled, The Baudelaire Orphan's Miserable Experiences at Prufrock Prep, I would paint Mr. Remora on one panel, Mrs. Bass on another, and a box of staples on the third, and the results would make me so sad that between the Beatrice triptych and the Baudelaire triptych, I would scarcely stop weeping all day. Mr. Remora was Violet's teacher, and he was so terrible that Violet thought she'd almost rather stay in the orphan shack all morning and eat her meals with her hands tied behind her back rather than hurry to room one and learn from such a wretched man. Mr. Remora had a dark and thick mustache, as if somebody had chopped off a gorilla's thumb and stuck it above Mr. Remora's lip, and also, like a gorilla, Mr. Remora was constantly eating bananas. Bananas are a fairly delicious fruit, and contain a healthy amount of potassium, but after watching Mr. Remora shove banana after banana into his mouth, dropping banana peels on the floor, and smearing banana pulp on his chin and in his mustache, Violet never wanted to see another banana again. In between bites of banana, Mr. Remora would tell stories, and the children would write the stories down in the notebooks, and every so often there would be a test. The stories were very short, and there were a whole lot of them on every conceivable subject.
One day I went to the store to purchase a carton of milk, Mr. Remora would say, chewing on a banana. When I got home, I poured the milk into a glass and drank it. Then I watched television. The end.
Or,
one afternoon, a man named Edward got into a green truck and drove to a farm. The farm had geese and cows. The end.
Mr. Remora would tell story after story and eat banana after banana, and it would get more and more difficult for Violet to pay attention. To make things better, Duncan sat next to Violet and they would pass notes to one another on particularly boring days. But to make things worse, Carmelita Spatz sat right behind Violet, and every few minutes she would lean forward and poke Violet with a stick she had found on the lawn.
Orphan,
she would whisper, and poke Violet with the stick, and Violet would lose her concentration and forget to write down some detail of Mr. Remora's latest story. Across the hall in room two was Klaus's teacher, Mrs. Bass, whose black hair was so long and messy that she also vaguely resembled a gorilla. Mrs. Bass was a poor teacher, a phrase which here does not mean a teacher who doesn't have a lot of money, but a teacher who is obsessed with the metric system. The metric system, you probably know, is the system by which the majority of the world measures things. Just as it is perfectly all right to eat a banana or two, it is perfectly all right to be interested in measuring things. Klaus could remember a time, when he was about 8 years old, when he had measured the width of all the doorways in the Baudelaire mansion when he was bored one rainy afternoon. But rain or shine, all Mrs. Bass wanted to do was measure things and write down the measurements on the chalkboard. Each morning, she would walk into room two carrying a bag full of ordinary objects, a frying pan, a picture frame, the skeleton of a cat, and place an object on each student's desk.
Measure!
Mrs. Bass would shout, and everybody would take out their rulers and measure whatever it was that their teacher had put on their desks. They would call out the measurements to Mrs. Bass, who would write them on the board and then have everybody switch objects. The class would continue on in this way for the entire morning, and Klaus would feel his eyes glaze over. The phrase glaze over here means ache slightly out of boredom. Across the room, Isadora Quagmire's eyes were glazing over too, and occasionally the two of them would look at one another and stick their tongues out as if to say, Mrs. Bass is terribly boring, isn't she? But Sunny, instead of going into a classroom, had to work in the administrative building, and I must say that her situation was perhaps the worst in the entire triptych. As Vice Principal Nero's secretary, Sunny had numerous duties assigned to her that were simply impossible for a baby to perform. For instance, she was in charge of answering the telephone, but people who called Vice Principal Nero did not always know that Celtipia was Sunny's way of saying, "Good morning, this is Vice Principal Nero's office. How may I help you?" By the second day, Nero was furious at her for confusing so many of his business associates. In addition, Sunny was in charge of typing, stapling, and mailing all of Vice Principal Nero's letters, which meant she had to work a typewriter, a stapler, and stamps, all of which were designed for adult use. Unlike many babies, Sunny had some experience in hard work. After all, she and her siblings had worked for some time at the Lucky Smells lumber mill. But this equipment was simply inappropriate for such tiny fingers. Sunny could scarcely move the typewriter's keys, and even when she could, she did not know how to spell most of the words Nero dictated. She had never used a stapler before, so she sometimes stapled her fingers by mistake, which hurt quite a bit. And occasionally, one of the stamps would stick to her tongue and wouldn't come off. In most schools, no matter how miserable, the students have a chance to recuperate during the weekend, when they can rest and play instead of attending wretched classes. And the Baudelaire orphans look forward to taking a break from looking at bananas, rulers, and secretarial supplies. So they were quite distressed one Friday when the Quagmires informed them that Prufrock Prep did not have weekends. Saturday and Sunday were regular school days, supposedly in keeping with the school's motto. This rule did not really make any sense. It is, after all, just as easy to remember you will die when you are relaxing as when you are in school. But that was the way things were, so the Baudelaires could never remember exactly what day it was, so repetitive was their schedule. So I am sorry to say that I cannot tell you what day it was when Sunny noticed that the staple supply was running low. But I can tell you that Nero informed her that because she had wasted so much time learning to be a secretary, he would not buy any more when they ran out. Instead, Sunny would have to make staples herself, out of some skinny metal rods Nero kept in a drawer.
"That's ridiculous!" Violet cried when Sunny told her of Nero's latest demand.
It was after dinner, and the Baudelaire orphans were in the orphan shack with the Quagmire triplets, sprinkling salt at the ceiling. Violet had found some pieces of metal behind the cafeteria and had fashioned 5 pairs of noisy shoes, 3 for the Baudelaires and 2 for the Quagmires so the crabs wouldn't bother them when they visited the orphan shack. The problem of the tan fungus, however, was yet to be solved. With Duncan's help, Klaus had found a book on fungus in the library, and read that salt might make this particular fungus shrivel up. The Quagmires had distracted some of the masked cafeteria workers by dropping their trays on the ground, and while Nero yelled at them for making a mess, the Baudelaires had slipped 3 salt shakers into their pockets. Now, in the brief recess after dinner, the 5 children were sitting on bales of hay, trying to toss salt onto the fungus, and talking about their day.
"It certainly is ridiculous," Klaus agreed. "It's silly enough that Sunny has to be a secretary, but making her own staples? I've never heard of anything so unfair."
"I think staples are made in factories," Duncan said, pausing to flip through his green notebook to see if he had any notes on the matter.
"I don't think people have made staples by hand since the 15th century."
"If you could snitch some of the skinny metal rods, Sunny," Isadora said, "we could all help make the staples after dinner time. If 5 of us worked together, it would be much less trouble."
"And speaking of trouble, I'm working on a poem about Count Olaf, but I'm not sure I know words that are terrible enough to describe him."
"And I imagine it's difficult to find words that rhyme with Olaf," Violet said.
"It is difficult," Isadora admitted. "All I can think of so far is pilaf, which is a kind of rice dish, and that's more of a half-rhyme anyway."
"Maybe someday you'll be able to publish your poem about Count Olaf," Klaus said, "and everyone will know how horrible he is."
"And I'll write a newspaper article all about him," Duncan volunteered.
"I think I could build a printing press myself," Violet said. "Maybe when I come of age, I can use some of the Baudelaire fortune to buy the materials I would need."
"Could we print books, too?" Klaus asked.
Violet smiled. She knew her brother was thinking of a whole library they could print for themselves.
"Books, too," she said.
"The Baudelaire fortune?" Duncan asked. "Did your parents leave behind a fortune, too? Our parents own the famous Quagmire sapphires, which were unharmed in the fire. When we come of age, those precious jewels will belong to us. We could start our printing business together."
"That's a wonderful idea," Violet cried. "We could call it Quagmire Baudelaire Incorporated."
"We could call it Quagmire Baudelaire Incorporated!"
The children were so surprised to hear the sneering voice of Vice Principal Nero that they dropped their salt shakers on the ground. Instantly, the tiny crabs in the orphan shack picked them up and scurried away with them before Nero could notice.
"I'm sorry to interrupt you in the middle of your important business meeting," he said, although the youngsters could see that the vice principal wasn't sorry one bit. "The new gym teacher has arrived, and he was interested in meeting our orphan population before my concert began. Apparently orphans have excellent bone structure or something. Isn't that what you said, Coach Genghis?
Oh, yes,
said a tall, skinny man, who stepped forward to reveal himself to the children. The man was wearing sweatpants and a sweatshirt such as any gym teacher might wear. On his feet were some expensive-looking running shoes with very high tops, and around his neck was a shiny silver whistle. Wrapped around the top of his head was a length of cloth secured in place with a shiny red jewel. Such things are called turbans and are worn by some people for religious reasons, but Violet, Klaus, and Sunny took one look at this man and knew that he was wearing a turban for an entirely different reason.
Oh, yes,
the man said again.
All orphans have perfect legs for running, and I couldn't wait to see what specimens were waiting for me here in the shack.
Children, Nero said, get up off of your hay and say hello to Coach Genghis.
Hello, Coach Genghis, Duncan said. Hello, Coach Genghis, Isadora said. The Quagmire triplets each shook Coach Genghis's bony hand and then turned and gave the Baudelaires a confused look. They were clearly surprised to see the three siblings still sitting on the hay and staring up at Coach Genghis rather than obeying Nero's orders. But had I been there in the orphan shack, I most certainly would not have been surprised, and I would bet what happened to Beatrice, my prized triptych, that had you been there, you would not have been surprised either. Because you have probably guessed, as the Baudelaires guessed, why the man who was calling himself Coach Genghis was wearing a turban. A turban covers people's hair, which can alter their appearance quite a bit, and if the turban is arranged so that it hangs down rather low, as this one did, the folds of the cloth can even cover the eyebrows, or in this case, eyebrow, of the person wearing it. But it cannot cover someone's shiny, shiny eyes, or the greedy and sinister look that somebody might have in their eyes when the person looks down at three relatively helpless children. What the man who called himself Coach Genghis had said about all orphans having perfect legs for running was utter nonsense, of course, but as the Baudelaires looked up at their new gym teacher, they wished that it weren't nonsense. As the man who called himself Coach Genghis looked back at them with his shiny, shiny eyes, the Baudelaire orphans wished more than anything that their legs could carry them far, far away from the man who was really Count Olaf.